supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Controversy around inclusion in Philadelphia's gayborhood has flared up again now that the club Eye Candy is partnering with three area organizations to reach out to people of color. Eye Candy became a flashpoint for racial tensions after a video of its owner, Daryl DiPiano, used the N-word, went viral last fall. Some in Philadelphia's LGBT community are boycotting the club, while those who are partnering with Eye Candy want to work with DiPiano to promote change. For WHYY, Kyrie Greenberg has the story.
Earlier this week, Daryl DiPiano released a video apology.
To anyone of any race that I have offended, I do sincerely apologize. I am extremely sorry.
Philadelphia Black Pride and two other groups serving people of color are partnering with his club, Eye Candy. Philly Black Pride will use the club for events during Pride Month over the next 2 years. Lee Thomas, executive director of Black Pride, says he wasn't on board right away when a community member initially asked him to reach out to DiPiano.
At first, I had reservations because I thought more about myself than I did about anything else, and I was like, no.
Thomas eventually decided that it was his organization's job to change the culture from the inside.
No one is negating the trauma that, you know, people have felt from being discriminated against, but we can't hold them accountable if we don't show them the right way. And who's best to show them the right way but people of color? We have an opportunity to work on race relations, and that's what we're doing, to hopefully get rid of the institutionalized racism.
But not everyone agrees. Fame Neal, who started an online petition to boycott Eye Candy, says DiPiano shouldn't be able to continue to profit off people he offended by using the N-word.
The bottom line for me is the owner is racist. You know, I go to where I know, you know, I am safe, and I go to where I know I'm accepted by the owner, by the staff. I don't feel like that's something that someone should put aside in the name of partying or going out to have a drink.
In May, Mayor Kenney signed a bill unanimously passed by City Council that gives the Philadelphia Commission on Human Relations the power to temporarily close businesses found to have a pattern of discrimination. It has not exercised that power yet. For WHYY News, Kyrie Greenberg.
Much of the debate in Harrisburg this summer has been centered on how Pennsylvania should overcome its sizable budget deficit. But as usual, there has also been a great deal of focus on issues related to public school funding and policy. Keystone Crossroads education reporter Kevin McCory catches us up on what's happened and what's to come.
If you haven't noticed, this is a historic occasion.
The summer began with fanfare in the Capitol Rotunda. A compromise had been reached on a long-debated effort to overhaul the retirement system for teachers and state workers. Governor Tom Wolf and the legislature agreed on a plan for new hires only that eliminates what workers currently get, a full guaranteed pension payout. Instead, they'll have the choice of a few options, which will give them a split between a pension and the type of 401k that most have in the private sector.
Simply put, this bill is a win for Pennsylvania taxpayers. It's also fair to Pennsylvania's workforce, and I will be proud to sign it in just a few minutes.
The measure goes a long way to protect taxpayers decades into the future, who will now avoid carrying the full risk of the stock market. In a downturn, new hires will shoulder a chunk of those losses, instead of state government and school districts being fully on the hook. Senate Majority Leader Jake Corman, a Centre County Republican, had been pushing a version of the bill that would have been much less friendly to workers, but he was happy with the final deal.
You know, we could all stand in our ideological purity, go to our corners, introduce legislation, and never get anything done. Or we could come together as a General Assembly and try to fix the problems of Pennsylvania.
For the past 7 years, pension costs have been rapidly rising, largely due to actions by state government in the 2000s. This has been a nightmare for local school boards, pushing them to hike property taxes and reallocate resources that otherwise could have been used in classrooms. The new pension plan won't change this reality in the near term. There's still a large debt that needs to be paid down, leaving plenty of tough decisions ahead. Jay Himes heads the Pennsylvania Association of School Business Officials.
So you either cut or you raise property taxes, and in some cases, districts end up doing both of those things.
Looking at this year's education budget is case in point. In late June, lawmakers and the governor reached a deal that boosted the main pots of cash for public schools by $120 million. Public schools across the state, though, must collectively cough up $150 million new this year for pensions. Again, Senator Cormann.
If you add up all the increase in pension costs for school districts, that doesn't even cover that. I mean, that doesn't even cover their pension increase from last year to this year.
For the past many years, this has been true. The rising costs public schools have faced in meeting pension obligations have been outstripped by the new money the state has dedicated toward the main pots of K-12 education funding, which in turn has led to many local property tax hikes. In part for this reason, education advocates have been calling for much larger yearly boosts from the state. This year, though, with Harrisburg facing a large budget deficit, advocates were satisfied with what they got. Susan Spica runs Education Voters PA.
School districts desperately need that funding. It isn't close to enough, but it is really at least something that will help stave off even deeper cuts and higher tax increases than school districts have already had to make.
The catch is that the state still hasn't come to consensus on how to pay for the spending side of its budget. So any increases at this point are, in reality, hypothetical. On another front, reforms to the state's 20-year-old charter law have remained elusive, with a leading bill stuck in a ping-pong match between the state House and Senate. Advocates like Spica think the current version of the bill makes it too easy for charters to open and expand.
It's going to make it very, very difficult for school districts to retain any kind of local control over, you know, responsible charter school expansion that, you know, local taxpayers are responsible for funding.
Charter school advocates like Tim Eller of the Keystone Charter Alliance laud the bill for promoting school choice, but have grown weary waiting for it to become law.
We're talking almost 6 years now. We've been trying to get some positive reforms for charter schools, and we're still not able to get this across the finish line.
There were other definitive actions. Career and technical education students now do not have to pass standardized tests in algebra, English, and biology in order to graduate high school. That requirement is still on the books for the rest of the students in the state, starting with the class of 2019. But it may be pushed back, and there's momentum behind abandoning the idea altogether. Whenever the state does finalize its budget, it will need to pass a new school code bill. As currently devised, the bill would allow districts to prioritize teacher effectiveness ratings over seniority when making layoffs. It would also prohibit districts from denying lunch to students who don't have the money to pay for it on hand. Kevin McCrory, Keystone Crossroads.
Street harassment is not a new phenomenon, but it is a pervasive one. We asked women on the street in Philadelphia about their experiences with street harassment. Here's what they had to say.
I think it's just annoying and unnecessary. Like, do people think, like, the girl that they're catcalling is going to, like, be like, oh, man, that guy just catcalled me in the car. I'm going to go get in the car with him. Like, I think it's just so stupid, and I just don't get the point of it.
I just ignore it. I don't give it much mind.
As a community, we should, like, really work to minimize it because it really benefits not only whoever's being catcalled but, like, everyone around.
Hate it. It's really gross. It's very degrading and sometimes very scary depending on the time of day.
Well, I think it's terrible. It's people are messing with other people for no reason at all.
Yeah, I think it can be humiliating sometimes.
Because I'm a heavier woman and full-breasted, so a lot of times guys would, you know, talk about that or say something in reference to that.
Actually, I was street harassed while reporting this story.
That last voice was our intern, Kate Summers, who went out to gather those voices you just heard. And yes, in the course of her reporting, Kate was catcalled four times.
Just as I was walking down Market Street, the same street that I, like, walked to the train station, I just had some people come up to me and be like, just, like, comment on the microphone or comment on, like, what I was wearing. One guy, like, put his arm around me and was like, I don't know, like, said something about how I looked. I usually, like, try to block out what people say, but, like...
So, but it got physical a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, which isn't uncommon. Like, people will, like, put their hand on my shoulder or put their arm around me or something like that. Just they felt like if they wanted to ask me a question or tell me how I looked, they could just, like, put their arm around me.
It's tough to pin down just how much catcalling happens in Philadelphia and elsewhere, but Anna Orso, reporter at Billy Penn, gathered plenty of anecdotal evidence for her recent article, Street Harassment in Philly, Unsafe, Uncomfortable, and Untracked. Anna Orso joins me now. Anna, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How does Kate's experience strike you? Is it familiar?
Incredibly. You know, I reported on this story for about a month, and in the course of that time, I was street harassed plenty of times, too. The morning after, about 10 minutes after the story went up, I was harassed on Market Street as well. Her story is not at all uncommon. But we do know from studies that are out there that were conducted by advocacy groups that something like two-thirds of women say that they've experienced this before.
And for the purposes of this reporting, what did you consider street harassment?
Catcalling, groping, stalking, following, leering, anything where a person or a stranger makes anybody, a woman, a man, a gender nonconforming individual on the street, feel uncomfortable or as if their space has been entered by a stranger.
However you define street harassment, there's a point at which it crosses into something darker, something illegal. You mentioned stalking, mm-hmm. grabbing, some type of assault. Do you have any sense of how common that is?
We don't, and especially not in Philadelphia. Reason being, the way that the police track crime is based on a federal standard called uniform crime reporting. There is no street harassment code when it comes to this reporting standard. Street harassment can be regular harassment. It can be assaults. It can be terroristic threats. It can definitely be not at all illegal. What many women think to be catcalling might just be legal.
Are there any studies on how often street harassment happens, and how would you go about doing that kind of study?
Sort of. There have been a couple of national studies. There's an advocacy group called Stop Street Harassment that did a study a couple of years ago that found that about two-thirds of women say that they've experienced street harassment. There was another advocacy group a couple years back called Holla Back Philly that did a local study. They found that 93% of women said that they had experienced street harassment in Philadelphia. But their problem is, outside of advocacy groups, there haven't been a whole lot of scientific studies on this. And that's what a lot of activists are calling for. They want public funding to go into studies and surveys to figure out just how often this happens.
And, you know, some of the studies that were done have found that gays and lesbians, as well as those who are transgender, have reported this at higher rates. Any idea about why that happens?
I spoke with Holly Curl for the story. She's the executive director of Stop Street Harassment. And to me, you know, I thought she described it great. She said that she feels like street harassment comes from a mixture of sexism, racism, and homophobia. That is my best guess for why members of the LGBT community might report higher levels of street harassment than their heterosexual counterparts do.
You know, it strikes me that street harassment is such a spur of the moment thing. It happens. It seems very much a situation of opportunity for people. If you had data that informed how often this happens, what would you do with that data? How would you go about creating an enforcement mechanism for something that just happens on the spur of the moment?
The problem is, I don't know if there is an enforcement mechanism. Data helps us in terms of education and in terms of, you know, community outreach and, quite honestly, getting men to better understand how common this is. You know, even men in my life told me I didn't realize how often this happened to women just because it doesn't happen when I'm around.
Anna, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
That's Anna Orso. She's reporter at Billy Penn, and you can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Driverless cars and online grocery shopping may become mainstream in the not-too-distant future. Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller enlisted the help of Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll, to gauge where Americans lean in regards to lifestyle trends.
Well, Frank, the shopping trend may have gotten a push when Amazon's Jeff Bezos purchased Whole Foods. To what extent do Americans do grocery shopping online? And I'm not just referring to Omaha Steaks or Maine Lobster, but I mean an entire order.
Well, we asked that question, and we find very few do. The way we phrased it was, order groceries online for pickup or delivery. Now, we also asked, Dave, how often do you or your family shop for groceries in person? And we have 70-80% of Americans who say at least once a week, and then the rest say once or twice a month. We have almost nobody who says they never shop for groceries, and just a few who say it's only a few times a year. So that's a huge marketplace there. And the percent who say that they shop online is minuscule. 4% say that they will order groceries online for pickup or delivery once a week or more often. And then slightly more will say they occasionally do it. But the bulk of Americans, 85% or more, say they've never even thought about doing that online. And of course, many of us never thought about a ride-sharing service before Uber came along, and most of us never thought about this massive delivery of everything we buy by Amazon at home. So what this suggests is there's room for potential disruption by Amazon in the grocery business.
If and when it does get underway, you think they'll be delivering more to homeowners or apartments?
We have found, I guess, in answer to your question, that fewer Americans now own their homes than used to in the past. But that doesn't mean they may not be renting their homes. But it looks like to us there are some more Americans who are living in apartments, so that may be where it goes. By the way, for those few people who do have groceries delivered, they do tend to skew younger. And, of course, younger people are much less likely to own homes than those who are older, so apartments would probably be the number one designation for those kind of services going forward.
We know, based on our conversation last week, that if you were to include cigarettes among groceries, those sales continue to drop. Though I understand there's data on whether Americans feel smoking should be banned.
Yes, Americans are down on banning almost anything, Dave, which is quite interesting. We found that on abortion. We have found that on other substances as well over the years. Maybe Americans have learned from prohibition that it just doesn't work when you try to say something's illegal because people will do it anyhow. We have over half, about 57% of Americans, who say yes, smoking should be totally illegal in public places. So you've still got over 4 out of 10 Americans who say no, they don't agree with the idea of making smoking totally illegal in public places.
Frank, I understand Gallup goes worldwide to poll on positive experiences. Explain what that means.
Positive experiences would be things like the following. Did you smile yesterday? Did you feel well rested yesterday? Did you experience enjoyment yesterday? And the place you want to go is Paraguay. That is the single country where when you tote up the things I just talked about, those positive emotions, that a higher percent said yes, they experienced those than in any other country in the world. In fact, South American countries, of which Paraguay is one, and Central American countries tend to be where people are the happiest, at least maybe not the happiest, but tell us that they experience these kinds of emotions.
Why?
Well, we don't know. I don't think it necessarily means that they are happy in a classic sense because none of them are without food or they all have lots of money and all that, because this isn't correlated with, you know, per capita income or things along those lines. So it's probably cultural. The U.S. is certainly above the median on a lot of these measures of both positive and negative emotions, but it's not up in the top 10. And the same thing for most European countries. And then the countries which are on the negative side are outside Europe. They are, to be specific, countries like Yemen, Turkey, Iraq, Belarus, Georgia. These are former Soviet republics. These are the countries where residents tell us that they're least likely to have happiness on any given day.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
Debate clubs tend to attract kids who really like arguing. And for the kids who really, really like arguing, there's Philly's Summer Debate Academy, run by the nonprofit ASAP. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron headed to Carver High School in North Philly to take in the final day of competition. He brings us this story from an especially heated contest.
Who doesn't love the story of collaborators turned rivals? There's Shaq versus Kobe, Lennon versus McCartney, and now, new to the list, Deja versus Jameer.
So we were partners about a couple months ago.
This is Deja Hall, a rising ninth grader at Girls High in Philly.
And we won first place. We knocked everybody out. Just a great combo. Come here. He's my opponent.
She's talking about Jameer Stratton, who used to be her debate partner when they both attended Laboratory Charter School in West Philadelphia.
We were like a perfect match. It was like
he could tell what I was thinking about without even me telling him.
Little did I know when I walked into room 212 at Carver High that this former power duo would be facing off for the first time ever. Naturally, the smack talk was flowing, with a little bit of sarcasm on the side.
Second place is the first loser. I can't be the first loser.
But you're going to have to. I'm sorry. You had to go to law.
John, don't forget what
I
came
can't out. Represent my country because I want to be president. I can't represent my country
forget,
as a loser.
Jameer, don't forget where you came from, okay?
I know where I came from.
Once the verbal smoke cleared, the debating began. The topic for today was whether social media has made a positive impact on American society. It was intense.
Awesome. Ben, hold on. I'm not done with my question yet. So actually
what's
this...
the question?
I'm getting there. Also with this cheating.
I mean, we're on a certain amount of time. So just ask the questions and I'll answer.
Back and forth, the words flew. The teams talked about cyberbullying, online charity, and even human brain development. When it was all over, Jameer's team prevailed, convincing the judge that social media has, on the whole, made American society better. But the coolest thing was watching two young people in their element. They like to argue, Deja and Jameer. And for 1 week this summer, they got to do exactly that. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
This summer, AI DuPont Hospital for Children rolled out a new reading program for its most vulnerable patients. From WHYY's Delaware desk, Shirley Min tells us about baby bookworms.
Nicole Hall's twins, Logan and Liam, were born 14 weeks premature.
Logan's doing a little bit better than Liam. He was a little bit bigger when they were born, so he's a little bit further ahead. And Liam's just kind of hanging out and trying to get off the little ventilator that he's on.
Because they were born so early, Hall's boys are in the neonatal intensive care unit here at AI DuPont Hospital for Children. Their every need is met in the NICU, including helping them grow their minds. NICU nurse Sarah Bakke came up with the idea of baby bookworms, a program the hospital started in June.
Baby bookworms is really about language nutrition. So language nutrition is the idea that, you know, we give breast milk to nourish the body, but words nourish the brain.
The program educates parents about the concept and coordinates volunteers to read books to the fragile babies 3 times a day, 7 days a week. Research shows exposing children to lots of quality words before the age of 3 gives them a huge academic advantage later on in life.
During 0 and 18 months, that's the period of the most rapid brain growth that occurs in life. And so when we educate parents and tell them this simple act of reading can have such a great impact on their baby's later academic success, I think that empowers them to really help, you know, play a role in that and feel like they're making an impact and partnering with us and the volunteers.
The March of Dimes Delaware chapter donated the books and the mobile cart that parents and volunteers can pull from. Nicole Hall, whose twins are in the NICU, likes how the program is focused on improving babies' developmental potential.
I think it's really cool just because we can't be here all the time. So to know that they're reading to them and kind of nourishing them in that way is really cool.
Hey, diddle, diddle, the cat and the fiddle, the cow jumped over the moon.
18-year-old Jessica Coulter volunteers at the hospital and loves how the simple act of reading a nursery rhyme can make a difference.
They really take that in, especially when they're in the NICU. They're hearing monitors and the same sounds, the same voices. So when you get a chance to bring them out of that zone, they really, really take that in.
NICU babies in other hospitals are read to as well, but Bakke says the scale of AI's program, the education of the parents, and having volunteers come on a regular basis is unique. Bakke says the next chapter for baby bookworms is to expand to other parts of the hospital. From the Delaware desk, Shirley Min, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by myself, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. We had help this week from our intern, Kate Summers. The news director is Eugene Son, and our assistant news director is Katie Colinari. John Mussoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineers this week were Al Banks and Charlie Kyer. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov for Newsworks Tonight.